You've heard of BetaShares. You've probably seen the logo on our podcast. You might even be among their 1 million investors. So you can imagine that I'm delighted to say BetaShares is the official ETF partner of the Australian Finance Podcast. With nearly 100 exchange-traded funds, you can go to betashares.com.au and immerse yourself in ETFs and unique insights covering all of the sectors, themes, core and satellite positions you could want. Think cybersecurity through the HACK ETF, robotics and AI with the RBTZ ETF, and uranium with the URNM ETF. The list goes on. To explore the BetaShares ETF range, visit betashares.com.au, read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website, and consider if the fund is right for you. BetaShares Capital Limited is the issuer.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
Hello, I'm Kate Campbell.
And I'm Owen Rask.
And you're listening to the Australian Finance Podcast.
A podcast where we talk about money, finance, investing, and all that good stuff.
We're helping you invest your time and money better one podcast episode at a time.
Yes, so please subscribe if you like the series. And don't forget you can find us on social media. We're on all the platforms. Kate, where can people go?
You can find us on Instagram and Twitter at Rask Australia. That's R-A-S-K Australia.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Owen Rask on Twitter, or Owen Rask AU on Instagram. Beware the imitators. People like to copy us. Without further ado, let's jump in to today's episode.
Mel, how are you going?
Hey, good. How are you?
I'm very good, thank you. I'm all the more better for having the opportunity to chat with you today, to chat with you about money, about spending, about investing, about everything, basically, and entrepreneurialism, things that you've been working on. We caught up in Sydney a little while ago, which was it was too long between drinks.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I'm hoping today we can cover a lot of ground, a lot of new ground for people that don't know you. You have appeared on our shows before, but maybe can you give us a bit of a 101 into Mel Brown? Tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got to here. There's so many books you've written and everything like that where people can go back and read, and we'll put links in the show notes. But tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got to where you are now.
Oh, God. So I am an accidental entrepreneur, an accidental accountant, and an accidental financial advisor. I feel like accidental is my thing. So I wanted to study law from school. That was my thing. I was very set on it, but 3 years in, worked out I hated it. Mm-hmm. And my dad was an accountant. I really wanted to please him. I was that oldest child people pleaser. So he said to me, there's law in accounting. Why don't you go study that? So I went and studied accounting. I say that my 13-year-old self would be horrified by that decision. She'd be crawled up in a fetal position crying, but nonetheless. And I only started my firm in order to do some more study. So I thought I'll put some flyers out that shows how old I am into letterboxes around my area, pick up a few clients and do some study. And 5 years later, I ended up with a business. And it was only when I divorced my first husband at age 33 that I took the opportunity to reassess and go, okay, let's stop this accidental nature and let's actually figure out what you want to do. Mm. And what I realized is I loved business. You know, I geeked out on Jim Collins and I started an MBA and really started to geek out on business. And I realized that my accounting gave me insight into the figures of so many business owners and into their wealth creation or lack thereof. And I was able to really transform their lives through that process. And that excited me. So I built that business. I started writing during that time because I love creativity and I love writing particularly. So I started a blog around fashion and business. And that became my first book, More Money for Shoes.
Yep.
And as a result of writing that book, editor of the Sydney Morning Herald rang me and said, so I'm surrounded by men in suits and you really seem like a chick. So would you come and write for us? I'm like, I'm not sure what that means or whether to defend it or not, but sure, I'm happy to start writing. So I wrote for Fairfax, a money column fortnightly for 7 years. I've written for everyone from Vogue to Cosmo to CEO magazine and more. And I continue to write books, including the global bestseller, UnF, I won't say the word, You Finances. And it was only and I started a financial advice firm as well, mm-hmm. during that time, because you know, for accountants to talk about self-managed super fund, we had to get licensed, and I knew the industry was broken. I really struggled finding financial advisors we could give clients to and feel comfortable and not feel like they were just peddling product and not giving strategy. So we decided to play in that space and not take commissions and just be full fee for service. Personally, at age 33, I gave my divorce settlement to charity and had to come back from less than nothing at that point, to a point where in my 40s today I have the choice to work or not, which is really cool. But just before the COVID hit, I sold my business to an ASX-listed firm for 7 figures, which I'm incredibly proud of. And because I can never not do something, I started to create an online course. It was my third go at it, and I realized that I'm really good at creating stuff and terrible at selling and marketing. So I decided to really go in and see if I could make a go of this online course world. And I've worked out since. I love it. I'm super introverted. So one-on-ones for me, which is how I've made money all my life, is really, it's so energy zapping. Whereas in the online course world, we can create incredible community where they really feel like they have a piece of me, but I don't have to do one-on-ones. So I now am all about financial education, particularly for women, so that instead of me doing it for you, I teach you how to do it yourself.
It's an incredible journey. For anyone listening to this or watching this on YouTube, pick up one of Mel's books and just see it in action, because she just made it all sound so simple. And I know from chatting to you that it hasn't been simple and it hasn't been linear. You know, it's been a lot of roundabouts and ups and downs on the way. So, yes, it's just so good to see you make that transition to courses and stuff as well, Mel, which is incredible.
It's interesting, because I think when you find something that you love, you know, less than 5% of women will start a 7-figure business. And I've now started 3. So accounting, preschool, and this. And it gets faster and faster each time, because A, you know the mistakes you don't want to make this time, but also you know what to prioritize. So I'm super proud of that feat as well, and the impact that means I can have.
Hey, actually, I was going to ask you this later in the chat, but I might bring it up now if it's cool.
Yeah.
I also share the passion for a lot of the things that you share a passion for. So one of the things that I've been working on lately, and one of the things I've been thinking about, is, you know, people starting small businesses. We have this tremendous culture in Australia of people starting small businesses, but there's so many people that will listen to this that think, oh, I wish I would just give it a crack. And they just lack that confidence. And one of the reasons why, Mel, is they are so fearful of making a mistake.
Yeah, absolutely.
I know we're just having a quick chat about this now, but is there anything that you could say to someone that might be sitting on the fence and thinking about those mistakes and things to avoid, like some of your lessons learned?
Absolutely. So you've got to get good at business. It's one thing to be a good technician. It's one thing to be good at selling your product, or, you know, if you're a mechanic and you're thinking, I want to go and have a go of it myself. It's one thing to be a great mechanic, another thing to be a great business owner. So you've got to get interested in how to run a great business. You've got to understand the numbers. And I don't mean that you need to become an accountant. You definitely don't. There's so much great software now that will spit out those numbers for you, but you need to understand the ones that are important for you and then the activity that you need to do to influence those numbers. So that's so that you're busy doing the right thing, not just being busy. And the thing that I would say as well is to back yourself. My biggest regret in business is that I don't back myself earlier. I think too often we're a bit cautious. So once you understand the numbers, once you start to skill up in business, it's having the courage that, sure, you might make some mistakes, but if you're willing to learn from them, then you can actually scale faster. But they're three really easy things that I still do it. If I take my eyes off the numbers, if I stop doing the fundamentals right, my business falters even now. And for me, I can tell you every part of my business. I can tell you conversion rate. I can tell you leads generated. I can tell you the size my database needs to be for the numbers that I need to hit. I know the activity I need to be doing this week in order to hit those targets. If you can't tell me that, then you've got a problem in your business. So you need to go and figure that out.
That's just great advice and so succinct. That transition from technician, like someone being really good at the thing that they do, to then being a good business owner is quite difficult.
Really, yeah.
Focusing on that and learning, you kind of have to be the specialist generalist. You have to know a little bit about everything and identify what's important.
And then you can give it away, because then you can keep an eye on it, versus if you hire everyone for everything early on, then you don't know if they're doing a good job or not. I taught myself Facebook ads. I don't intend to hold on to them forever, but when I hand them across to someone, I want to understand, are they doing a good job? Is the spend worth it? I want to be able to speak their language. So it's doing the same in your business. You don't need to hold that skill and be doing it all the time, but in order to make great strategic decisions, I don't want to be at the mercy of someone else holding that knowledge.
Wonderful advice. And I like that analogy of just not wanting to hold it the whole time. It makes a lot of sense, because that's the part where we have to give up the responsibility and a lot of a struggle. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's shift gears a bit, Mel. Let's talk about so this is on the Australian Finance podcast. Let's talk about some finance and some of the things that you've been working on lately. Yeah. You mentioned you've got the online course, and a big part of it, if I'm not mistaken, is this idea of financial empowerment. It's basically giving people confidence to tackle their finances and just go about their life knowing that they feel secure and, you know, motivated, stronger, all of those good things that we want to feel when it comes to money. I guess maybe just to set the scene, what does financial empowerment mean to you?
So financial empowerment for me means I can sleep at night knowing that I'm being proactive rather than reactive. It means I have choice. So it means that my finances are set in such a way that I have choice and options for what I'm going to do in my life. But also I've got that knowledge to where I can make decisions versus having someone tell me what I should do. So I see at the moment, let's just look at property, where, yes, there's less people at auctions, interest rates are going up. So I'm seeing people smashing down their mortgages and not investing and being scared to go to auctions because no one's there. So therefore it mustn't be a good decision because the herd's not there. Whereas financial empowerment is, this is my long-term goal. I know where the path that I want to take with my investing and with my finances. And I feel really confident in the decisions I'm making, regardless of what the noise is in the marketplace, the noise is in the media, or what everyone else is doing. So me, that's financially empowering because I feel like I'm in control and I feel like I have choice.
I think that's fantastic because, you know, there's that, you know, if you do the average thing, you'll get average results. And I feel like if you can feel confident enough to stick your head out and say, you know what, actually, I think people are still going to be living in houses in 10 years and I want to buy or invest in a house. So now's a good time, it seems.
You could use that analogy with shares. You could use that analogy with business. People are still behaving the same way. where they're so scared to go against the herd. But it is that confidence in your own decision and your choices.
I guess one of the things, though, Mel, is people would hear us talking like, I'm a finance person, you're a finance person, trained as an accountant, and they think, well, it's easy for you guys to say that, you know, you've done this for a long time, whatever. How do you try and instill that confidence in other people, you know, someone that doesn't come from maybe a finance background?
So for me, it's all about education. And it's acknowledging that that's not always easy, particularly if it's not something you feel like you're naturally gifted at. So earlier this year, my husband is the physio for the canoe slalom team. So Jess Fox, who won gold at the last Olympics, and that team. So he's going to Paris with the team next year, and he's been traveling a lot over there for work. So we made the decision earlier this year, we're going to study French. So it all went pear-shaped pretty quickly because he got really sick. But in the few, we probably did it for about 4 or 5 weeks. The first week, I was like, oh, this is fun. We're learning the alphabet. Like, it's a novelty. Mm. Week three, I'm like, oh, God, my head hurts. I haven't learned verbs and whatever since year 10 or year six. Like, it was hard and it didn't come naturally. And all I wanted to do was throw my hands up. But what I know is that and we're going to go back to it, when we stick to it, when we practice it, we'll actually become maybe not expert speakers, but proficient. And it's the same with our finance and financial knowledge. Yes, you may not want to go and study at university like you and I have. You might not want to become a finance professional, but you want to increase your knowledge to such a point that you're proficient in what you want to do in your life. Mm. And that will seem a little bit hard. Certainly when you're doing it, you'll feel like your brain quite literally hurts sometimes because especially if you're not used to thinking that way or especially if you've not taken the time to learn about money before. But it's abso-freaking-lutely worth it, which is why I'm such a strong believer in education when it comes to finances.
I agree wholeheartedly. I've never heard I had a similar attempt with my German lessons, and I got to admit,
attractive language.
it exposed my lack of knowledge of English, that was a bit of a hurdle. But I guess one of the things that there's around about 1,800 people have enrolled in your online course, Mel, which is incredible, plus partners and whatever, and kids. I guess one of the things that, you know, you would be coming across is people have maybe what you might call like limiting beliefs, or they might have just hurdles in front of them. You know, we can all think of, oh, sure, I want to, you know, buy a house. I want to go on a holiday and I want to afford it.
Yeah.
But then there's that other part of the brain that creeps in. It's like, yeah, but you still got a bit of credit card debt, or do you know enough about this? Like, how do you overcome those roadblocks that people put in front?
Yeah, how do you stop the lizard brain from taking over?
Yeah.
So I firmly believe finance is personal. I don't have a one size. If someone says to me, how much should you be saving? I would say that's absolutely the wrong question. So I believe finance is personal. And that comes down to how we all think and behave and act with our finances as well. So the first 2 weeks in my course, we actually address that. So I look at the nature and nurture side of what you believe. So nurture being your mindset, what the messages that you grew up with, whether you think money is good, bad, or okay, and what money stories did you grow up with? And people are so surprised that so many things that they firmly believed are truths actually have no grounding in reality at all. You know, in the same way that we use a pig for a money bank, and no one knows, you know, I've asked that question at every event that I've spoken at. There's not been a single person that can put their hand up and tell you, but it was a mistake. So pig was the name of the clay that people kept their coins in back in the day. A merchant from the UK went across to Europe/Asia, saw these and went, what a great idea. Wrote to his factory and said, I want pig pots, P-Y-G-G, because that's what the name of the clay was. People had forgotten why they called them pig pots, because it was just that tradition handed down. And it was quite literally like a bowl, clay bowl. So the factory manager got that request and went, oh, okay, I guess I'm making pig-shaped money boxes. The owner came back and looked at these hundreds of pig-shaped money boxes and went, what have you done? And thought, oh, well, I'm going to have to sell them now. And that mistake is why they were an instant hit, and that is why we have the current money box.
Oh, wow.
And no one knows that. And it's the same with the beliefs that we have, that we are not enough, or that we're a creative, therefore I'm not good with numbers, or women aren't as good as at investing, or but I wasn't good at maths at school, therefore. We've come with so many beliefs. So the first 2 weeks for me are all about addressing those and rewriting them, as well as figuring out what money type you are, so the way that you naturally behave. So it's really important work to dive into.
I love that analogy, Mel. I did not know.
Such a good analogy, right? Yeah.
I did not know that. And so I've been thinking that money boxes, like the little pigs, the piggy banks, I didn't even know where they come from.
Mm.
So,
and we don't think to know. That's the funny thing. We just accept that it's a pig. And so much of what we believe about money, we've just accepted. Like the 20% saving rule. That was an Elizabeth Warren book back, I love saying, last century. That she wrote last century, and we've held on to that now. If you ask people, majority of people will say, I should save 20% because it's something someone wrote last decade that we've continued to carry with us. We don't understand where it's come from. We just hold on to these truths. And in an age of declining financial literacy, more and more I think we grab hold of things because we lack the knowledge. So we grab onto those things, not necessarily knowing where they've come from.
I must admit, Mel, it's been a couple of years since I read your book, the one that has a great title, which I'll put in the show.
Budgets for Work, yep.
Yeah. And even, like, I could see, like, the evolution of your writing over time and how, you know, we could think about people and kind of like their personality types and how that influences their habits and their beliefs about money. And I remember looking at that, and I remember looking at that and thinking, there's so many people in my family and friendship network where I can identify some of the things that they must have been taught. They can't see it,
but I
could see it because I was like on the outside.
Yeah.
And once you understand some of those things, I think it's just like a superpower. You're like, wow, like I get
Absolutely.
It now. Like that thing. You know, that's
not
how the world
works. Yeah,
that
thing that's been holding me back, or that thing that's driven how I have been behaving, it's actually not right. Mm. And I think that's freeing, because then you get to choose what you want to believe and what you want to have going forward, and reduce, absolutely remove that limiting belief that has potentially held you back.
Mm. A bit of a question you probably get a lot, right? And this might come into the mix. We'll talk about, like, partners and friends and stuff in a minute. But one of the things that people, like, I have this mate of mine who says, oh, you can't take it with you. That's his saying, right? So he kind of like,
that's a problem for future me. Yeah, exactly. Can't take it with you.
So how do people find a balance between, okay, I'm saving money, I've got this money saved for holidays, long-term investing, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
But I don't want to become a miser. Like, I don't want to deny myself of every experience. Yeah. How do you find that balance?
I think it's a number of different ways. So I think there will be some seasons where you might be a miser because you're going for a really short-term goal that you're really excited about, and you're happy to suffer in the short term. Mm-hmm. So I kind of talk about sprints and marathons, and we can't run a marathon forever. And we can't go at the pace that a sprinter will for forever. So it's having a long-term goal that you're really excited about. And that would include things that you might want to do in the short term.
Okay.
And if you've got a short-term goal, such as, let's just pick an obvious one for Australia, to buy your own home, then you may want to deprive yourself for 12 months or 18 months because you're so excited about that. You might be happy to house sit and pet sit and not spend for 18 months, but you don't want to do that full time. And I think that's why it's important to understand there's sprints and marathons. We don't always want to be sprinting, but also I don't want my future. I don't want to have such a good time today that my future self is in a caravan drinking cask rosé, having to wear hand-me-down Crocs. Like, I'm not interested in that for her. So it's both a goals exercise, I think, to be as excited for that picture of 10 years' time as you are for today, and putting things in place so that you still enjoy today, so you still have enough funds, but you're also looking after future you. But I think as well, it's letting go of the entitlement and expectation around what now needs to look like. You know, when I was growing up, I shared a room with my sister. We had one TV. We had one car for the family. We never went on an, we didn't go on an overseas trip till, I think it was 16 when we went to New Zealand, the big occasion. but nowadays, the expectation of what is a basic right is so different than that. So I think there also needs to be that expectation of, well, that this is what society says that I should have, but what actually do I want? And that's the really important thing I think is necessary in goal work, to ask the question, what do you want? Not what does society want for you, not what do marketers say that is the bare minimum, not what your parents want for you or your peers want for you, what do you want? And only when you're excited about that. You know, if you said to them, you know, in 10 years' time, if you were having a beer with yourself at your next significant birthday, what would you want to hear? And if they could tell you that and then say, right, so what are you doing about that? And often when you change the lens of how you look at these things, that's when you can start to get excited about it.
I feel like there's so much in there. There's like regret minimization. There's also that independence, which you talked about before, is, you know, it's just not accepting the status quo. And I think there's so much of that. Listeners of the podcast will hate me for saying this because I've said it about 100 times. It's like, it wasn't until I got a vision board that I started to actually write down the things that I want in life, like in my 20s, 30s, 40s, whatever. It wasn't until I did that I was like, oh, well, now I can invest with intention and I can spend with intention, which was a really big thing for me.
Because otherwise you just invest what you think you should and you're not excited about it. So your motivation for it is a whole lot less than you being excited about a picture on your board.
We were chatting off air, Mel, just before we hit record about over Christmas, you're going to be doing a goals-based it seems like forgive me if I'm wrong, it seems like a workshop where, you know, men and women, but women primarily can come in, and if they've got these New Year's resolutions or, you know, they think like 2023, that's my year.
That's my year.
That's my year. And if I had a dollar for every that, you can see podcast rankings, Mel, you can see January is a huge year for us, right? But then December's really quiet.
Yep.
And I do this. I go and join the gym, right? So I'm one of these people. So not knocking on anyone. But
I'm the opposite. I'm like, oh God, I didn't do that. So I finish the year hard.
Okay, right. Okay. Yeah. And then burn out into Christmas. Totally. Yeah, cool. But so how does someone go from, you know, oh, I've got this goal for the new year? How do they actually stick to it? Like, how do you keep yourself accountable? How do you do all that stuff?
You got to have intentionality. Like for me, that's it. It's just like your vision board. It's the difference between, I think this is what I should do. Mm-hmm. You know, I know I should care about money. So I'm just going to make that my to-do for next year. Whereas if there's no intentionality, then it's just going to become your New Year's Eve resolutions will become a shopping list or like a wish list that you used to write for Santa back in the day. Like it's really meaningless. So for me, it's doing that exercise around what do you actually want? You know, what do you want in 10 years, 5 years' time, 10 years' time? What does that look like for the next 12 months? My husband and I do something called My Best Year Yet, where we look at all the different parts of our life and we ask the question, what would it mean for that, what would need to happen in that little part for us to have our best year yet? So it's something I learned from an EO conference in New York. So we do it from relationships to family to money to health to personal development, like it all is in there. So we then have and then we drop that down from there to 90, 30 and 7-day sprints. So my husband knows that every second month he has to do a couple of dates. We know financially what we're working towards that year. I'm comfortable with, we've agreed on how often we're going to go away each quarter or how often he's going to travel for work. And it's not then a shock when you get to September and it's like, oh crap, I meant to do something about it. But also you're then running in the same path together because you've set that intention. And it's not just that we want to do better with money. It is, as I said, we set dates every second month. I'm buying this property or this much in shares or doing this with my business. We put figures and KPIs around them so that you actually know if you're going to do it. And then we have an app called AnyList that we keep it all on. And once a month on one of our dates, we just pull it out and we see how we're doing. And for me, it's the difference between that Santa's wish list or that, you know, New Year's resolution where the impetus for it has gone away as soon as the hangover disappears on the first, to actually doing something about it.
That's really cool. And I like that. So I just wrote down some of these things, but our best year yet. I feel like a lot of people listening to this can be like myself included, can be like, well, I want to make 2023 a better year. Frankly, I do. So how do I go about that?
It doesn't mean that you're not going to have crap happen. You know, since doing that, hubby's had cancer. We've had family deaths. You know, we've had really significant things go on. But in every year, we can genuinely say we had our best year yet because we emerged from that year as a couple, no matter what happened, stronger. And whilst some of those years we might not have had ticked everything off our list, we ticked a bloody lot more than we would have if we hadn't done that in the first place.
I just love that that's kind of the team-based goal as well. And you broke it down into 90-day, I guess. So you call the long ones a marathon. And then what's the 90-day?
The sprints.
They're the sprints. Okay, I like it.
Yeah, and then 90, 30 and 7.
90, 30 and 7. And then you've got the kind of the date night where you check in and you reassess, which is really cool. It's a good way to do it.
And he's not a planner. Like, he's so not a planner. Okay. And it wasn't until we found this template of what to do that it actually worked for him. But he can cope with once a year sitting down. And then after that, it's just a how are we going? And he likes it because rather than me going, oh, come on, are we doing this? He knows what we're both working towards. And importantly, he knows what his part in it is. Because it would be really easy for me as a finance professional just to take charge of everything. But I want him to have agency as well. So he's got agency with some of his things that he's contributing towards it, which is really important.
I feel like it's crucial, that you need to feel that sense of – that comes with the empowerment that we talked about earlier on, right? Like, he's got to feel like he's got – the power to do it. He can do it himself as well. And there's something that he wants. He can work towards that.
Exactly.
I really like this. I really like the smell. I think that, I guess, a lot of people that listen to this, like, obviously you guys come together and you do this. One of the things that we've talked about recently on the show is trying to get our partners or our friends or family to talk about money is one of the hardest things. So I guess, How do you even break down that barrier and start talking about money?
For me, you start it with that curious lens. So if you go hard, if you've got a family member you've been worried about credit card debt with and you go in with judgment, they're potentially going to close up shop. Yeah. But if you go in curiously and even say, hey, I listened to this chick where she talked about something called money stories and mentioned the piggy bank, what money stories do you think you have? And then it's a curious conversation versus a judgmental conversation. So I think that's important. But also using techniques like best year yet is a way where, even from what it's called, your intention is that we both want something positive out of this. We're not there to rip each other down. They're going, and you do it separately. So it's something that you do separately and then come together. And it means then you've got common language to be able to regularly during the year have a conversation that is just a check-in to say, how are we going with this? So I think finding ways like this to do it. And if a partner won't engage in a curious conversation, if a partner won't engage in something like best year, that would be a red flag for me to say, what's going on with them that they won't engage in money? And it would be having the courage to have that conversation to say, it's not okay that you won't talk to me about this. Can you tell me about your reasons that you're reluctant to? And if they still won't, then you've got to speak to a professional. You both go into a therapist or something like that. Because for me, that's a version of financial coercive control. Whereas if your partner refuses to engage with you about money, they're controlling what you're able to do financially. It's a version of control. So you've got to go and get that seen to really early on, or when that red flag erupts for you.
Do you find, Mel, and I couldn't agree with you more, it's such a hard, that is such a hard conversation to have, because on
such
the one
a
hand,
hard conversation.
You can, on the one hand, you can just totally love someone, and then that comes yep. to money and they freeze up and they have so much insecurity.
Yeah.
And on the other hand, you want to achieve these things and you want it to be healthy and open and, you know, strong mm. relationship. Do you find that when people come into the course, do you find that they often have their partners with them, or
is so often not- will happen is one of two things, either the partner's doing it together from the get-go or they're doing it together from the get-go, or one of, usually the woman joins and she shares exercises with her partner and they'll be like, oh yeah, that's interesting, that's curious. But it's only when she starts to make real strides or makes real change in their finances that the partner goes, oh, that's interesting. I want to go and play with that too. So either when they pull out the financial strategic plan and they're really starting to work on that, when they're calling their home loan provider and going to their partner and saying, well, I just knocked 0.5% off the home loan. You know, what have you done? Like, it's when you're mm-hmm. making that tangible change, often that's enough to pull the partner in to go, ha, huh, I want to know what this is about. I thought it was going to be fluffy and it's anything but that. But also sometimes even early on, because if, you know, what we know from late relationships Australia, money is the number one thing couples fight about. We fight about it twice a month. So even just being able to have someone come and want to have a genuine curious conversation about money can sometimes be enough to stop that heat. But I think it's also important, like we're talking about having those conversations, it's important to acknowledge that there are either in a relationship, it can become problematic. You know, if a there's awful stats that where a woman's earning out goes past her partner's, and if that partner is a male, her risk of domestic violence goes up by 30%. So there are instances where women can feel really reluctant to engage financially. And if you want to stay in that relationship, then it is going and finding your own financial independence, as well as speaking to a financial to a therapist. So I've worked a lot with women who are building their own wealth, regardless of what you're doing as a couple. Because if I'm not going to press pause just because you won't talk about it with me, or just because you feel threatened by what I earn. But the other thing is, I think there are some people that it's not appropriate to talk about this with. So, for example, I wouldn't talk about it with my mother. It's not that I don't love her. It's that she has, you know, she's grown up, to be honest, looking back, with a bit of financial control there. If I was to share stuff with her, she would be frightened, she would be scared, she'd try to talk me out of it. With business, she would go, oh, are you sure you want to do that? So I don't want her putting her limiting beliefs on what I think I'm capable of. So I'll ask her curious questions, I'll share things with her that might be interesting, but I absolutely have strong boundaries around what I'll share as far as what I'm doing. And that's where sometimes we feel that we need to be able to talk eventually with this to people. You know, we're excited about it. We want to talk to everyone about it, but it's not necessarily something you should do if they're going to be putting their limiting beliefs on you. That might be someone that you go, right, that's a boundary around that one, and this is what I'm prepared to talk to you about.
It's really interesting. When we talk about how people consume financial news, we say that it's really important to understand the source and the motivation of the source. I think we're all becoming a bit more wiser to that these days with politics and whatever. But I think that also applies to people that we talk with about money. You mentioned a few things here that I hadn't heard. So did you say that there's some research that suggests that people can argue or fight about money up to twice a month? Is that correct?
Yeah. So the Relationships Australia, money is the number one thing we fight about. And the average is we fight about it twice a month. So if that's going on in your household, you're not going to want to talk about money with your partner because you want it to be pleasant. So, and that's why for me, when you said, how would you bring it up? For me, it's always about curiosity and not judgment. in a way that's positive rather than negative. Because otherwise the presumption's going to be great. You're just going to hassle me. And also, and this is something for heterosexual couples, the media talks to men and, to money about men and women differently. So Starling Bank research showed that 90% of articles directed at men is all about having, you know, you it's using fear as techniques about with money, and that money makes you more of a man. Like, you know, those awful messages. Whereas with women, more than two-thirds of articles are that we're overspenders and that we need to cut back. So what message are we taking? We're saying that you need to have more money and you need to stop spending it. So that's the message and the mindset that we're bringing into those conversations, which, again, could be a myth. So it's realizing that and undoing a lot of that and recognizing it. And these are all the sort of things we talk about just in the first couple of weeks.
Yeah, well, I hadn't heard of that research. I'm writing a lot of this down when we chat, Mel. But I tell you what, fellas, if you're listening to this, one of the best pieces of advice you'll get from me is try and encourage your partner to earn more than you, because it's it
my
is.
My husband would agree.
It is incredible. So go but and
also
give that a
ask
crack.
The question: how would you feel about that? Because you know that research around domestic violence sadly is true. But I think, so especially for men where they go, oh, I think I'd like it. You know, my husband is really, he loves that I earn more than him. However, he will, when he went away overseas this year and he earned substantially less, we both agreed that he would contribute to our joint pot. He would stop contributing to our joint pot. But he couldn't go and turn that off in his bank mentally. He was like, I can't not contribute as a man. So I actually had to log in and turn it off for him. And he was very happy for me too. And I joked. I said, do you want me to do it? He goes, maybe. So I think, and it's, I love that you say that, but sometimes we can give lip service to it. But when the actions come, it's actually, it is sometimes something where if that's something that's wrapped up in our identity to say, well, what could I bring to the relationship if it's not money? And it can be so much more. You know, my partner brings so much, whether it's providing with meals and providing other things. It doesn't have to be financial. So it's just a rewriting of that whole narrative around what does it mean to have these norms when it comes to our roles financially.
Yeah, and it's money's only one part of our life, right? It's
an
important
part.
Such an
important part. Yeah.
Yeah, there's so much more to it. So it's not like disarming in any way to have a partner that earns more. Someone's got to probably earn more unless you have identical wages, which I would say is quite rare. So.
I'm not asking for a pay rise because I'm $20 above you. It's your turn next.
That's it. Mel, as we come to the end of the conversation, there is something that we, Kate and I, did want to talk to you about. Obviously, it's just me here today, but... you did a webinar which showed like 50 plus ways to save or to find 10K, so $10,000. And we'll put a link to that in the show notes. If we'll also have a link to Mel's course and to the website. So everyone, you can go find out more about Mel, and I highly encourage you to follow her on Instagram as well. But what is, I guess, just a couple or a few of the ways that people can move towards that goal of 10K? I know I would like to find 10K.
Yeah. Well, the reason I did that, just to preface it, is because what I realized when everyone was ripping 10K out of super at the beginning of COVID is that people don't know how to find more money. You know, we know how to tighten our belts, but we don't know how to find more money. So I've run that a number of times since, and every time it's one of my most popular webinars, simply because people don't know how to find more money. It's not a skill that we've been taught. So some of my favorite tips from that is one that will get rid of your cost of housing. So if you're stuck on that rent treadmill and feel like you just can't get ahead. And some of the questions are, what am I prepared to suffer for? But you could house sit. Yeah. So for me, that underpins it. You could house sit or you could pet sit and get rid of your cost of housing. Completely get rid of it. So I have a girlfriend that husband unexpectedly left her December last year. She's house sit for the last 12 months and been able to save a phenomenal amount of money because her cost of housing was gone. she would be in a wildly different position now if that was the case. And she's saved, she's found way more than 10K from that one tip. So that's just one. Another one is to be aware of your lazy assets. So if you've got a property, like if you live in the CBD, even if you have a driveway, you can rent out that driveway. That's an asset. You could rent out your car. If you've got a swimming pool, you could rent out your swimming pool. You know, people were running out and buying caravans during COVID. You can rent out that caravan that's just sitting in the yard now. But you can also rent out tools that you have, or the projector that you use once a year, or clothes that you bought for a wedding that you're not going to intend to wear again. So if you don't want to sell that stuff, it's asking the question, what lazy assets do I have that I might not even realize are assets? And can I rent them out? And there's loads of websites from Swimplify to car websites to Rent My Closet. There's so much that so many websites dedicated for renting out these things. And the other thing I would say is, and I know we talked about business, is a side hustle. You know, I believe everyone has a side hustle in them. Not everyone's meant to give up their day job, but everyone has a side hustle in them. Either it's putting your skills online, whether it's starting a small course, whether it's selling a product, whether it's doing some consulting, I believe everyone has the ability to earn a little bit extra on the side. It's just what platform's going to be right for me to do that, and then how can I set up very quickly and easy to start selling.
I like it. So we've got that like housing one. I've had the experience with house sitting before, and I remember that and a friend of ours actually saved their entire house deposit by doing that. Of course, they had to have kind of like a in-between place, which was their parents' place if they wanted to crash for a couple of nights in between. But they basically saved their entire house deposit that way.
And in between, you can even pay, you might pay for Airbnb or a cheap hotel, and that's still so much cheaper than renting might have been.
Yeah, for sure it is. Yeah. Lazy assets, I love that. Whenever we go away as a team, we don't use like the Hertz or the traditional hire cars. We use Car Next Door, which is an app that you can download.
Yeah.
And it's just everyday people just renting sharing their cars. Their car. Yeah. So much cheaper.
So much cheaper. GoGet, which is another great one.
Yeah, And side hustles obviously speak for themselves. So this is a fantastic list.
But Mel, we've got travel, we've got fuel, we've got food, we've got all these different ways to save in there.
Yeah. Yeah, cool. So that will be in the show notes if you want to find out more, as will the goals mini course that you've got coming up in December.
Yeah.
I'm not mistaken, 6 lessons, $97.
That's to be right. Part of it.
It's pretty, very affordable if you're just dipping your toes into trying to get more from yourself. But it's also, you know, your online course, which is it only has limited intakes every year, which I think is kind of cool because it adds scarcity to it.
Yeah.
When is the next opening of that course?
January 23, and from memory it's the 21st of January.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so jump on the wait list because we've got cool bonuses if you do.
Yeah. There'll be a link in the show notes. And I think a lot of what I've taken away from today, Mal, it's clear that I'm promoting your course here and we get nothing for it, but I'm just saying it's clear that anyone coming in to that would get value for money because I've even written down so much here about just actionable ways. And when we first met many moons ago, you said to me, what are you prepared to sacrifice? And that stuck with me as like, that is the secret to budgeting basically.
Yeah.
What are you prepared to sacrifice and getting comfortable with that? So thank you for taking some time to join me on the show and share some of your wisdom. And when we catch up in a couple more years, I'm keen to see where you are next. But in the meantime, I wish you all the best with this. And thanks for taking some time to share that wisdom.
Oh, you're so welcome. It's always a pleasure to chat to you.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Australian Finance Podcast, where our mission is to improve the financial futures of all Australians. If you'd like to learn more, create a free account at rask.com.au/account to download free episode workbooks, bonus resources, and take our amazing free personal finance courses.
You can also join our online community by following the link in the description. If you enjoyed the show, what we'd love is for you to leave us a snappy review on iTunes. And you can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Rask Australia. Kate and I are also on both of those channels. Finally, if you have any feedback, suggestions for episodes or guests to come on the show, or you just have a question for us, shoot us an email at podcasts@rask.com.au. I am so excited to tell you that InvestSmart and Intelligent Investor are long-term sponsors of this podcast. And here's something I want to tell you about. The Intelligent Investor Select Value Fund is a unique mix of global leaders and homegrown small caps poised for long-term growth. The portfolio manager is Nathan Bell, a talented investor you may have heard on the Rask Network multiple times. The Select Value Fund is designed for investors seeking international diversification and Aussie companies with superior financial metrics. You can invest today at intelligentinvestor.com.au/IISV-offer. That's intelligentinvestor.com.au/IISV-offer. Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that Rask could help you in 2024. As many of you know, Rask has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies, which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at Rask, which is the launch of our Rask Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high-growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high growth strategy focuses on longer term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside Rask Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community. You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the all-star stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called Rask Core. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 Rask community members have begun the Rask plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if. You want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy, insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that, but one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian property podcast by Rask, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of RaskCore, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax? I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nevexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All RASK users get 20% off an annual plan with Nevexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nevexa's software, and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nevexa, but they do create some great tools which the RASK community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number nine, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the RASK YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the RASK network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that. All of that by going to the RASK Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. RASK Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the RASK Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000, and hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support RASK and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the RASK network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.